Welcome to today's edition of Centered, a reasonable conversation about life and faith with your host, Dr. Don Belenis, Ph.D.
Those of us who enjoy reading spy thrillers, such as novels by John le Carré, we're accustomed to entering into a world filled with potential disasters and great evil geniuses. Our guest today makes use of that kind of writing to alert us to a far greater and very real threat to the Christian Church. Oz Guinness is a social critic, a co-founder of the Trinity Forum, and the author of more than 25 books. Born to medical missionaries in China during World War II, Oz is the great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, the famous Dublin brewer. Before coming to the U.S. in 1984, he was a freelance reporter for the BBC. Our focus today is the new edition of his book, The Last Christian on Earth, Uncover the Enemy's Plot to Undermine the Church. Welcome back to Centered, Oz.
Pleasure to be with you again, Don. Thank you so much.
Well, I certainly enjoyed your book. It's a serious read, but an entertaining read nonetheless. Why did you choose the spy thriller genre for this particular book?
Well, if you think, whenever the church goes captive to culture, in other words, in the biblical term, worldly, it's always a mixture of blindness or short-sightedness. And the best way to get people to see what they're doing is to get them to see it from a wider perspective. Now, C.S. Lewis, of course, used the famous genre of a devil speaking to a junior devil. But that was to tempt individuals. And this book's more about the church as a whole, so it's much closer to something like Jean le Carré. Mm-hmm. That's why I used it.
Yes, yes.
To help Christians to see themselves from the outside.
Right. I enjoyed it, especially the asides as you went through, the bits of ironic humor throughout, but it is a book, I would like to say, an adult book for serious thinkers and serious readers, and I think an encouragement to serious Christian thinking.
And I hope it will lead people to really think and pray.
Yes.
And I hope they will end the book on their prayers, because we're in a desperately urgent time.
Right. Indeed we are. You begin with a thesis, what you call the grave digger thesis. Could you tell us what that means?
Well, put very simply, it's the idea that as the church created the modern world, so it has gone and become captive to the very world that it helped create. And in essence, it has become its own grave digger. And you can see the thesis is used by Marx once in a very different context, and much earlier, though, it's used by the Puritans. The way that the notion of calling produced a tremendous prosperity, and then that very prosperity undermined and virtually killed the notion of calling. And so you can see today that the Christian faith is the single strongest factor behind the rise of our advanced modern world, and yet we've been undermined by the very world we helped to create, the so-called gravedigger thesis.
Mm-hmm. So it could be stated, I guess, that in a way, from this perspective, at times at least, the church's worst enemies can be Christians themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And it's always the success that blinds us, and we fall captive to our success. Very few people can argue against their own success. So you think of what was said at the early church, that the price of the Christianization of Rome was the eventual Romanization of the Christian church. The Pope, for example, had the titles and was virtually the parallel to the emperor. And in the same way, you might say the price of the westernization of the gospel, that's the cost of what we've done. And you can see that today.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, you call for biblical and theological faithfulness, of course, for Christians, though you do it in a kind of a reverse and interesting way. But you also strongly advocate careful use of the social sciences, including what you call a sociology of knowledge. What do you mean by that?
Well, for many people, it's a dirty word or an unknown word. But we think, in the scriptures, the notion of culture or the world is very, very important for a number of reasons. A positive reason is witnessing. You need to know someone's cultural context in order to speak to them truly. But the negative reason for using and understanding culture is the danger of worldliness. Now, of course, to recognize worldliness, you have to have the proper tools to recognize it, and you need to recognize it in order to resist it. And for me, many Christians are good when it comes to the tool of the history of ideas. They can trace the influence of ideas, humanism, Marxism, whatever it is. But they also need the sociology of knowledge, because what that deals with is not ideas, but whatever passes for knowledge that is shaped by the world in which they live. So history of ideas starts with ideas and goes from thinkers to their thoughts to the impact on the streets. Sociology of knowledge looks at simple things in our life worlds, like cell telephones, televisions, and cars, and things like this. You wouldn't think are influential in terms of ideas, but actually they have a tremendous impact on us. And we need to use both tools. It's not one or the other, but both. And many Christians just simply don't understand the world. And the most useful tool today is the sociology of knowledge. But I always say, get the idea and drop the term.
Mm-hmm. Sure. In the book, your fictional spy, your protagonist, is being sent from the academic stratosphere of Oxford University to, of all places, Los Angeles, California. Why did you choose Los Angeles as a place for this fictional opponent of the church to be posted?
Well, I took Oxford because it's obviously a symbol of the sophistication of ideas that are often hostile to the gospel. And many people think of the attacks on us as only things like the new atheists, people like Richard Dawkins in Oxford. But I took L.A. as a counterexample because the dangers in L.A. are never to do with ideas. They're much more to do with a laid-back entertainment lifestyle, image-conscious culture that L.A. has become. So I took L.A. as the epitome of a whole way of life that is not actually shaped by ideas, but is equally seductive and therefore dangerous to the gospel.
Some of us, many of us, I think, take some comfort from the fact that, at least in the United States of America, religious statistics indicate that despite significant decline, most Americans at least say they believe in God, and many, compared to other countries, still attend religious services or religious events or happenings or whatever. However, you are more concerned in this book with Christian influence. Please explain that.
Well, you can see there's a real hollowness in the statistics in America. They've remained steady for 50-odd years. You know, 86-point-whatever-it-is say they believe in Christ. 40% go to church regularly, things like this. But suddenly, in the last years, there's been a rising number of people identifying themselves as secularists and a declining number, especially among the young people, of people who no longer identify themselves as Christians. So the statistics have become soft, and I would say they're rather like a house eaten by white ants that is still standing, but is almost on the verge of falling. And so we shouldn't bolster ourselves with confidence in numbers. You know, in the Old Testament, David's reliance on numbers and polling and counting the people was considered a sin. And I think too many people bandy statistics around today too airily and don't look at the real integrity and effectiveness of the gospel in the lives of Christians, and that's much more serious and alarming.
And so you are particularly focusing on the influence of Christians in the public as well as the private square.
Yes, you could put it like this, Don. I mean, groups that are tiny, like the gays or lesbians, have extraordinary cultural influence in America today that's out of all proportion to their numbers. And Christians, who have a huge majority numerically, are culturally insignificant in many areas. And that's because the Christian church today, in many, many areas, lacks the integrity and effectiveness of living out the gospel and therefore having influence as salt and light in the culture. Now, the book is, as you know, an explanation of the forces that have rendered the church impotent in this way.
Yes.
So we shouldn't just look to statistics, but look far deeper to the integrity of Christian living.
Yes. And among those most potent influences that you cite are secularization. What makes that so, has made secularization so powerful?
Well, the rise of the modern world. Now, of course, secularization is highly controversial as an idea, and there have been distorted, bad versions of it. The old idea that as the world gets more modern, it gets more religious, so secularization means the disappearance of gods, God, and the supernatural. dead wrong. There's an explosion of religion around the world today, religious resurgence. But you can see in our modern society, religious ideas, not just Christian, but religious ideas in general, are either more marginal, in other words, they're at the fringes of life, or they're less meaningful. They're not considered part of the, quote, real world. So put it like this, Don. In the past, before the rise of the modern world, and this is true of non-Christians too, what was unseen was not unreal. But a feature of our modern world is what is unseen is now considered unreal. We live in a world, as Peter Berger says, a world without windows.
Mm-hmm.
In the modern advanced technological scientific society, what you can touch, taste, calculate, weigh, measure, and so on, what you can approach through the five senses, that's the real world. And what you can't approach through the five senses, the unseen world, it's unreal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the traditional world, the unseen was actually more real than the seen world. And people understood things as basic as sex and farming and law in the light of the unseen. But today, it's only what's seen, what we call often measurable outcomes and that sort of thing.
Yes.
That's the real world for modern people. But that means, in many ways, the church is much more secularized than it realizes.
And some of the practices of the church whereby things are, I don't know, tremendously simplified or narrowed or weakened, I'm not sure. I recently came across the titles of a couple of books, one called Prayer for Dummies and another one called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Prayer. Now, in both these cases, I dare say the author's intent may be important, laudable, but I tend to cringe when I read such things. Can the Christian faith be dumbed down?
Well, it shouldn't at the end of the day. Now, of course, we always relate the faith to wherever people are. The Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 9, I'm a Jew to the Jews, Gentile to the Gentiles, to those under the law, I'm under the law, to those outside the law, I'm outside the law. In other words, we always start where people start.
Yes.
And some people have a very dumbed-down way of living generally today, say, cartoons rather than reading the New York Times. So we always start where they start. But here's the point. Today, many evangelicals start where people start in order to reach them, but they stay there with them, and they become dumb too.
Mm.
Now, you take the example of someone like John Bunyan. Not a day of schooling. But as C.S. Lewis said, the only reason it doesn't take education to be a Christian is that knowing Jesus is an education in itself. In other words, someone like John Bunyan came to Christ without any great schooling background, but just read the scriptures, literacy, plunged into the depths of theology like Romans, and his sermons and his writings sound deeper than many pastors who are in university towns today. Because so much of the faith, I'm afraid, has been dumbed down as we started where people start, but we've ended there too, which is tragic.
Yes. Well, my next question has to do with encouraging people who come to faith in Jesus Christ to come up, move up, straighten up, and strengthen up. Among other things, your book is a strident call for serious thinking by Christians in every sphere of life. How has the application of human reason shifted in our time? And perhaps more importantly, how can we, as Christians, help reverse this trend?
Well, we've shifted, this is very broad, from the Enlightenment era, which is often called modernity, to the so-called postmodernism of our age, which has given up a belief in reason, a belief in truth, and all those sort of things. And sadly, many Christians have followed them once again. But at a time when people like Richard Dawkins and others are calling us faith heads, in other words, we don't think when we believe in something that has no reason behind it at all. This is absolute rubbish. And we're called as followers of Jesus to love the Lord our God with our minds. And Jesus adds that to the Old Testament command, which is not in that string of commands in the Old Testament. And we've got to be transformed, as Paul says in Romans, by the renewal of our minds. So Christians who are not thinking are not only handicapping themselves, because you can't be in modern culture without thinking. It's a very thoughtful culture. But worse than that, Christians who aren't thinking are really sinning against the Lord and failing to love him with their minds. Now, thank God for books like Mark Knowles, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, and the huge strides that have been made in the last 30 or 40 years. but there are still all too many glorying in an irrational faith, which in today's world is a disaster.
Not all of us can become in any way, shape, or form intellectuals, but all of us can use our God-given mental abilities. But how would you suggest our listeners who are interested, concerned, worried about the state of the church, how can they, in local church settings or organizational settings, reverse that trend and encourage people to think seriously about their faith and life itself?
Well, I think first, start with all the scriptural teaching about thinking Christianly. The negative examples, the positive examples. In other words, it isn't something we add on to discipleship. It's at the very heart of discipleship, loving God with our minds too. But then secondly, people need to set up a lifestyle of keeping abreast, reading certain books, and above all, being in groups and in fellowships that really do think. So as things come out, we see them in the newspaper, we watch them on television, we really understand them Christianly. So just as it said in Chronicles, David's men were skilled in reading the signs of the times. You know, so Christians should be today, and will be, as they develop a Christian mind and the gift of thinking Christianly.
One of the modern Western gods which you highlight, and I've seen so, so very much in my own life experience, is the God of unending choice. And I was recently listening to a radio program on another network featuring a man who had resolved to be a member of a variety of religions, to practice these religions for a month at a time. So he had resolved to be a Muslim for a month, be a Hindu for a month, be a Jew for a month, and so on, and then to report on his discoveries. What has become of permanence with regard to faith, and faith as part of our identity?
Well, it's often said that one of the biggest shifts in the modern world, with the rise of the modern world, is the shift from fate to choice, or you might say from givenness to choice. And we're grateful. I mean, you go into a supermarket, which is the epitome of America, and you have 50 cereals. And people who come from a culture with no cereal, or say three on the shelves, it's a remarkable thing to see modern consumer choice. But with choice, and then, of course, change happening so fast, you never want to be stuck with anything, because there always might be something newer and truer, better and greater, the latest is the greatest, and so on. So today, people don't close on things. They're always open to something new that may be better than what I have now. And sadly, that's not only cereals or technology, say the latest app coming along. You haven't got the latest iPad, 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever. That also now happens in marriage, a better woman, a better husband, or whatever. And, of course, it happens in faith. And many people are forever shopping and shopping and shopping, but without ever really buying something and staying with it permanently. Now, you know, even say the Californian marriage vow is no longer till death do us part. It's so long as love lasts. Well, not very often. It's rather fickle and romantic. And doesn't last very long without a covenant commitment. And you can see that lack of permanence and that ever being open, always looking for something new, is a feature of modern society that's extremely dangerous. You take, say, worship services. The old term service, worship service, has been replaced by the American term worship experience. Now, a service is just that. We worship and serve God through our worship. An experience is all about us. And if we don't like the music, we don't like the preacher, we want a better architecture, go on down to another church. And you can see how many people are just hopping and shopping and channel surfing in all sorts of areas where they shouldn't.
Now, you've lived in the U.S. for some time, and you maintain a critical perspective, though, of an outsider. And your statement, when I read it, that the God of American civil religion is Americans themselves, that really struck me. Is American patriotism, which is often, I'm afraid, bordering on jingoism, is it unique in the world?
No, not at all. But there's always a great danger for the world's number one power, because when they conflate their nationalism with their faith, it becomes dangerous for others in the world as well as themselves. Now, let me go back to the idea of civil religion. Some countries had established religions outside themselves. But civil religion was the word that Jean-Jacques Rousseau used for countries that had no official religion, but they discovered that whatever bound themselves to each other was the thing they respected and revered, and then eventually came to worship. Now, in America's case, it's clearly things American. So Americans in civil religion are truly worshiping themselves. There's nothing wrong with patriotism, the love for our own place on earth. But patriotism, when it shifts across into nationalism through notions like civil religion, can become extremely dangerous. And the trouble is, many Christians identify, when that happens, with their country first rather than the Lord first. And you can happen with many, many European countries. I'm sure it happened with Britain in times past, certainly in Germany, and so on. But we're at a point, rather like St. Augustine, when he called Christians to break with Rome. And remember, in Augustine's time, Christian Rome was seen by Christians as what would carry the gospel around the world. And Augustine said, no, the city of God is not the city of man. And I think we're in a similar period today when Christians have to show their first allegiance is Jesus and the kingdom of God. It is not America, however good America is and however grateful we are for our own good countries.
Yes.
We've got to show that we're Christ first, not Americans first.
Yes.
It's true of political parties. I live in Washington. Sometimes you can't tell whether people are Republicans first or Democrats first or Christ people first, and that's disastrous.
Yes. Yes, that truly is the center. Before we run out of time, I just need to ask you, at the end of your book is appended the Evangelical Manifesto of 2008. What's new with that?
Well, it's an attempt to call evangelicals back to a proper definition of evangelicalism, which would then be a reforming impulse in the movement, because evangelicalism has lost its way. It's become American. It's become cultural. It's become political. And many of the people giving up being evangelicals, they're giving up something which evangelicalism should never have been. But if you define it properly, evangelicals are those who define their faith and their lives by the good news of the kingdom of Jesus. And if we live in the light of that definition and reform ourselves daily by that standard, we will truly be evangelicals. When Francis of Assisi tried to live like Jesus, the Pope called him evangelical.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of being middle class or cultural this or political that. It really is a matter of the good news of Jesus, and we need Reformation renewal in evangelicalism.
Yes.
The Protestant mainline has become worldly to its own fault, mm-hmm. and evangelicals are beginning to look like a mild equivalent of liberalism several years after the Protestant liberals. This is disastrous.
Yes.
We need reformation. We need renewal. We need revival.
Dr. Guinness, I thank you for your contribution to our thinking and also for being on our Center program today.
Always a pleasure, Don. Thank you so much.
And for everyone, please be reminded, this is a very important book. This is a new edition. It's called The Last Christian on Earth, Uncover the Enemy's Plot to Undermine the Church. And if you have questions or comments to make, please contact me directly. My email address is dgb@centeredonline.org. A final word on the evil one's threat to the church. Listen carefully to the Apostle Paul's famous sentence in Romans 12, verse 2. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, pleasing, and perfect will. A mind renewed is a mind remade according to God's design, that is, God's good, pleasing, and perfect will. We need to fully apply our God-given mental as well as spiritual abilities to the state of the Christian church today. Major course corrections are needed if the Lord's work is to be done in our public as well as our private lives.
Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for your kind and thoughtful attention. Yeah, and check out our website. Remember, it's www.centeredonline.org.